Cody and Amy Miller. The Chief Justice will participate in this panel by listening to the tape.
May it please the Court, I'm Joshua Gordon. I represent the appellant, Jerry Cody. This case involves the custody of a young child, and it should be remanded for the lower court to figure it out. To change custody, the parole case requires that the movement prove a great alteration in circumstances affecting the child's welfare. The alteration causes a strong possibility of harm to the child, and the harm has to be caused by the parent from whom custody is taken. None of these were proved or even alleged in this case. Now, there is a problem with the parole standard. It doesn't deal effectively when there are two good parents. It really best addresses abusive situations. But I want to take first the alteration of circumstances. The same exact number of pickups and drop-offs before and after modification take place. Other occasions requiring communication, such as doctor's visits and school, etc., do not change. Amy had moved to Massachusetts before the divorce, so that doesn't change. The master placed the need for change in custody squarely on the undeniable fact that Amy and Jerry do not communicate well. But they have never communicated, not during their marriage, not after the marriage, not after the divorce, not now. And that hasn't changed, and that can't form the basis of an alteration of circumstances. That the child is going to school also doesn't create an alteration, because that's easily foreseeable, just like the child custody cases. And here it was actually foreseen. It was in the divorce stipulation. But even if there is an alteration of circumstances for parole, there's no harm caused by Jerry, alleged in the record, never mind proved, and thus no basis for awarding the child to Amy rather than Jerry. And the GAL suggested 8 criteria. Time spent with the actual parent, the GAL wasn't able to distinguish one from the other. Flexibility of each parent's schedule, GAL found none. Helping with schoolwork, GAL said they were both capable. Availability for after-school activities, ability of each was the same. Fostering discipline, this wasn't really addressed, but there's no reason to believe that the parents are any different in this regard. Encouraging the relationship with the other parent, the evidence suggests my client's a little bit better, but the GAL said there's no substantial difference. Whether a parent has to work. Now, the GAL on this one testified that he recommended Amy get custody because she's a stay-at-home mom. And the source of a parent's income, the last criteria, the GAL acknowledged that his recommendation was based on the fact that Amy's husband is the source of her income and Jerry has to work for his. Based on the GAL's own criteria, therefore, there is little difference between these parents except in working and income. But working and income are just sex discrimination by another name. We live in a society where still more men than women are forced to go to work to support their families. And sex discrimination is happening in custody determinations. Right now, in New Hampshire, just 14% of dads get custody. And this case starkly presents the issue. And it's illegal and it's unconstitutional. This court should address this issue with a written published opinion. By not addressing it, I think the practice is condoned. The remedy here is to reinstate joint physical custody so both parents are jointly responsible for the care of the child. It's what was bargained for at the beginning. There's no basis for change. This court should remand to the court below to figure it out. I'll take questions.
You're not challenging, or are you challenging, in your notice here, in your brief, the parole standard for joint custody situation?
I've not challenged it in any way. I think I commented on it momentarily. And in all candor, you should know, if you don't already, that RSA 458.17 has codified parole as of January 1st, 2000. It doesn't really affect, 2001. It doesn't affect this case. And I could imagine an argument that someone might make that the codification is different than parole itself, but it doesn't really apply here. But I'm not challenging this standard.
Because it seems to me, in looking at this, that when you have joint physical and legal custody, the parole standard doesn't really fit that very well. And it seems to me it ought to be somewhat of a best interest test. I mean, the status quo somewhat remains in place. It's not the traditional parole case where one party has primary physical custody of the child.
Right.
They both have physical custody of the child.
Right.
And circumstances have evolved where someone's complaining about it. I'm just curious as to why the court shouldn't look to the best interest. You said the statute won't allow the court to do that?
Well, the new statute, and you can read that. I'm not sure. I don't think it applies to the case. But my argument, and I don't see any way out of it, really, is that this is a parole case. And if it's supposed to be a best interest case, you know, that involves this court overturning 19 or 20 of its holdings, I think.
Well, I don't necessarily think that's true. I don't know that the court has ever applied in a published decision the parole standard in a joint custody circumstance, have it?
I listed the 20 cases in my brief. I will review them to see whether that's so. I don't know the answer.
It may not be a preserved issue.
It's really not. But there are problems with the best interest standard too, as I've briefly outlined in my brief. Some states have experimented with those sorts of things, and they are difficult because they have very little content. So this sort of latent sex discrimination which favors mothers may even play a bigger role in those sorts of in a best interest standard because it's essentially standardless. So I'm not sure if the court is considering adopting a different standard. I'm not sure that's the way to go. Someone with more expertise than I needs to be consulted.
If we remanded this case, would the news? I'm trying to look at the statute. I hadn't looked at it before. Would this new statute apply to this case?
I don't think so. This case was decided under law that was existing before January 1st of this year.
Well, does it apply to the statute apply to pending to other cases where custody disputes come up?
Well, I don't know exactly when new statutes begin to apply. I'm quite sure it doesn't apply in this case, but the effective date of the statute, it doesn't say effective to what, whether it's marriages that took place or
right.
Custody. I don't know.
What's the current situation with respect to school? I mean, it seems to me that's what complicates it, right?
I think so.
So how does it work out currently?
I believe the child is not yet going to school, despite the thought.
I thought she was in kindergarten.
She missed the cutoff by a week or two, and so I guess won't start until this coming September, I think.
And so how's that going to work?
Well, I don't know, and I don't pretend that this is an easy case to decide. You have two good parents living, you know, two-hour drive.
Right. Right. She has to go to one school.
She's got to do something. I understand now the mother has moved. She no longer lives in Plymouth where she didn't live. I don't know whether that makes it better or worse. It's a difficult case, but, you know, on the existing law, parole has to be measured up to, and I don't think it was even alleged.
I share Judge Broderick's view. I mean, as you said earlier, the school situation is foreseeable.
Right.
At some point, the child's going to go to school. And so at some point, having the child, I don't know, live half the week here and half the week there just isn't going to work.
This court...
Let me just finish. I don't know if there's case law that addresses this, but how do you apply when they haven't negotiated the school situation at the front end, which they should have, because we know the kid's going to go to school,
mm-hmm.
then why apply parole where it's just got to be one or the other as a primary caretaker or parent at some point in time?
You may be right, and unfortunately the law doesn't leave an out. In fact, there may have been an out at one time where if parties want to negotiate under best interests,
right.
This court really cut that off in tough part, I think. You know, that even if you negotiate a best interest, parole is the law, the court said, and I'm not sure there's a way out of that anymore. That be all? Thank you.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court, my name is C. Michael Salenz and I'm counsel for, Amy Miller, formerly known as Amy Cody. two words I'd ask this court to keep in mind as I go through my argument, and those words are unrealistic fiction. Unrealistic fiction. And those words came from trial marital master Leonard Green, who heard this case over the course of 3 days. This is a joint physical custody relationship. It was always intended, and if you look at the party's final stipulation, it was always intended as a temporary fix. As a matter of fact, there's language in the final stipulation that states that the parties will review the custodial relationship, anticipating that the child is going to have to go to school at some point. The parties live in different states. It's an unrealistic fiction to say today that this child can still be with both parents in a joint physical custodial relationship. This is truly a fact-driven case. And after you look at the transcripts, after you look at the judge's orders, after you look at the guardian ad litem's report, you will see that there is a sound and substantial basis in the record for Master Green to have ruled as he did. And we're asking you to uphold his ruling today. What the judge did, what Master Green did, was essentially look at the totality of the circumstances. You have one parent living in New Hampshire, one living in Massachusetts. You have a child who's soon to start kindergarten, and if memory serves, I'm going to represent that she is in kindergarten today. Half-day kindergarten. Lack of communication between the parties and the schedule that they had was a week on, a week off. Certainly it can't work under current circumstances. The driving case in this is the Peralt standard in Peralt versus Cook, and that's been cited by counsel and in Ms. Miller's brief as well. What Peralt does, and counsel's already articulated it, is essentially provide a three-pronged test. First, there's been a great alteration in circumstances affecting the child's welfare. Well, there has been, because the parents live in different states, because the parents can't communicate, because the child has to start school. The great alteration will create a strong possibility of harm. Well, we had a guardian ad litem who concluded that, and that is, his report is full of statements that, under the current situation, the child faces great harm now and in the future. And we also have Master Green who concluded that. Now, the third prong, the harm is caused by the parent from whom custody is being taken. Well, let's look at that briefly. Master Green correctly concluded that both parties love their child. He also concluded that both parents are fit parents, well able to take care of their child. Well, if you look at Peralt, what Peralt concluded in the end was that there was no evidence that the plaintiff was an unfit father. However, this court did take custody away from him, and one of the reasons was because that work delayed him, and he was forced to rely on his parents to take care of his children. Similarly, in the case of Cody and Miller, you have Mr. Cody who works full-time. Mrs. Miller made the conscious decision to quit work and be a stay-at-home mother. You have testimony from Mr. Cody that oftentimes during the trial he would leave his house as early as 3 or 5 in the morning and oftentimes not return until 6, 6:30 p.m. You have testimony from him which also states that his wife, his second wife, also worked 10 hours a week, and that his daughter was being taken care of by a nanny. That was important to the guardian ad litem. That was important to marital master Leonard Green. On the other hand, you have Amy Miller, who has made the decision to quit work. She's home to take care of her child. The court concluded that it would be better in the child's best interest to be with a parent than in the care of another. Now, that segues into the bias issue, the sexual bias issue. And frankly, it's an interesting topic. It piques people's interest, but that's not what it is here. It's not bias. What the court did was look at the child, looked at the long-term interest in the child, and found that under the current situation, the child was going to be harmed. This is not a case of sexual bias at all. As a matter of fact, Master Green recognized that, and he said, it's part of the record, but what he did say was that the world is an unfair place. And I don't mean to sound crass by saying that, but I am quoting him. It's an unfair place, and that's what we have here. It's not a matter of sexual bias. It's simply the child is better off, and her long-term care is better off with the mother. Thank you.
Counsel, tell me if you can, what circumstances changed after the divorce was granted? You give me a litany that he works and this and that, but he worked at the time of the divorce. I just want to know what happened, what's different now than it was at the divorce.
Well, first and foremost, what's different is that mom's home. Mom is home to take care of the child.
Okay. And that creates, that meets the parole test? Because mom now is remarrying, she can stay home. Therefore, parole?
No, that does not meet the parole test.
I don't think so. What else is it?
It's the totality of the circumstances. I'm going to tell you, Your Honor, what that is.
I want to know what circumstances change. I don't want to know what the circumstances are. I want you to freeze frame the divorce circumstances. I want you to tell me what has changed. You told me mom's now home. What else is there?
The child is in school. The child can no longer be shuffled back and forth. And when I say shuffle, I'm using the language from parole.
That's a neutral. That applies. That can be just as much mom's fault as dad's fault. Right? That's a neutral. Everyone knew the child was going to go to school. That shouldn't be somehow the... I want to know what factors the trial court should consider that either changed after the divorce or weren't obvious at the time.
Well, for example, and this is reflected in the transcript, the communication between the parties is so poor. It's reached, if I could, Your Honor, it's reached certainly an all-time low. And as an example, just one example, but I think this goes a long way towards answering your question. Mom had the child's ears pierced, okay? Dad didn't like that. So when Dad picked up the child for his period of visitation, he tore the earrings out of his child and threw them out of the car window. Well, that had a very big impact on the guardian ad litem and on the court, because what they said was that Mr. Cody is putting this child squarely in between he and Mrs. Miller. She is not being shielded from the animosity. Whereas there's never been any allegation that my client has done anything like that. So I think what the guardian ad litem and the court did was look to this example and determine that this example could simply persist.
You said in your argument, made a note of it, it was always intended to be a temporary arrangement.
It was intended to be a temporary arrangement.
Now, if that's true, why in the world would the law force these people and force the court into applying parole subsequently? It seems to me if it were a temporary arrangement, then what the court should be allowed to do is to say, all right, it's temporary. I don't have to find anybody who's causing great harm to the child. I just need to take a second look and see now that the child's in school, what are the best interests for this child? I mean, aren't we asking the court to create a fiction here to deal with a school situation?
But it's more than a school situation, and I'm hoping that I made myself clear when I provided you that example earlier, that it's more than a school situation. And what Master Green again said, this is an unrealistic fiction. It's unrealistic to presume that there can be a joint physical custodial schedule in the future.
I understand, but you said it was a temporary arrangement.
Well, the parties recognize that they'd have to reevaluate it at some point in the future.
Based on parole?
We don't know.
Of course not. They were going to take a look at it and see how it worked going forward. I mean, I assume two adults don't sit down and say, this is temporary for the child, and I'll have to prove that you're basically an unfit parent or it would cause a great hardship to continue the custody. I assume they thought, we'll take a look at it and see how it's working. Wouldn't that be rational? It just seems like the law is imposing on everybody, not being critical.
But
it seems like the law is imposing on everyone this fiction, so we can't get to the realities and deal with it sensibly.
Well, I think that's a good question, and it is an open issue, quite frankly.
But the purely legal issue is, Peralta assumes some kind of permanent status of the divorce, and that assumption just doesn't apply in this kind of case. And so there's no purely legal. As a purely legal matter, the standard shouldn't apply.
Well, but, you know, the other argument is that at some point there has to be some finality here.
That's what Peralta assumes. And this kind of case does not assume that. And since the assumption underlying Peralta does not exist, the principle shouldn't apply.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think this case does... I
didn't expect you to.
I think this case does shout out for some type of finality. You know, unless we have some type of finality, which Peralta affords us, these parties are going to keep going back and forth. The child is going to be living in limbo, quite frankly, and I honestly believe that the guardian ad litem's suggestion that she faces long-term harm is very real.
But the other problem is that it also encourages, and I don't mean this to talk too much about the evidence in this case, but it does encourage people to try and gather evidence about the incidents like the earrings, about the bees, and all kinds of things in order to meet this test. The test is so demanding that you try and put together a case to meet that test, and you get fact patterns like this where you have all kinds of incidents that may not be blown out of proportion, but they certainly become, whether she was stung by a bee becomes, you know, blown up into a big incident to try and meet the test. I mean, that it seems to me it puts the parties and the lawyers in a very bad situation as well.
Your Honor, my practice is entirely family law. Okay, and I see this very frequently. You know, the issue of the bees. I agree to another party. It may not be an important issue, but to my client at the time, it was a very important issue. And that's part of the emotion that goes into family law cases.
Wouldn't it be more sensible? It may not be possible in this case. It may not be possible ever. But wouldn't it be more sensible in a joint physical, joint legal custody arrangement to say to the lawyers, why don't you come in and argue best interests of the child? Seems to me that's what the court in that sort of situation ought to be focused on. And no one has to have a black hat. And the law forces you to find a black hat.
But no one has
it. Critical of the lawyers or the parties, but under this circumstance, it just seems like a torture fit.
No, I don't agree with you, Your Honor. Respectfully, no one's wearing a white hat or a black hat in this case. You know, as I said before, similarly with Peralt, what the court said was that the father's not an unfit father. And that's what Master Green said in this case. He's not a bad father. But the totality of the circumstances are such that the child should be with the mother. And in Peralt, the court said the same thing. And the court said he's not unfit, however, the child should be with a parent.
Peralt is a much higher standard to me than a best interest standard. Would you agree with me on that?
It is, certainly.
Thank you. Case submitted. Did you have something you wanted to
add? I want to stick with two factual issues. The first is Attorney Sons alleged that my client has 12-hour work days. He put two facts together to come up with a new fact. My client at times goes to work early but then comes home early. Sometimes goes to work late and comes home late but doesn't work both ways. On the earrings, there's testimony had no impact on the child. Apparently she didn't witness it. Thank you.
Case submitted?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.